Hey, my friends, welcome back to the FASD Family Life Podcast. I'm Robbie Seal. I'm an FASD educator and an advocate and the mom of five incredible people, including three teens diagnosed with fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. And it's my hope that by sharing my experiences and my education with you, that you will no longer feel alone or hopeless on your journey raising your children with FASD. And I'm proud to say that the FASD Family Life Podcast is the only podcast dedicated to fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, hosted and produced by a parent who's living it. That's why I always say, I understand the struggle is real and so is success. I'm living it too. And it's my privilege and honor to bring you this podcast week after week after week. It's a free gift. However, it takes a lot of time and energy and focus to bring you the guests and pull together the episodes and do all the editing and be on social media. It takes a lot of time. So if you're in the position to help me continue this work, I would be so grateful. Would you consider being a monthly sponsor? Your gift of $20, $10, or even $5 a month would go a long way to supporting me and enabling me to continue to provide value, education, encouragement, and to equip you and other parents as we together are raising our kids with fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. Now, I invite you to settle in with me with a nice hot cup of coffee for a fun and lively conversation with Dr. Jodi Carrington. She is a renowned psychologist and is sought after for her expertise, energy, and her approach to helping people solve their most complex human-centered challenges. Jodi focuses much of her work around reconnection. Reconnection, the key to healthy relationships. As a speaker, author, and the leader of Carrington & Company, she uses all she's been taught in her 20-year career as a psychologist to empower everyone she connects with. Jodi has worked with kids, families, business leaders, first responders, teachers, farmers, and has spoken in church basements and world-class stages. The message remains the same. Our power lies in our ability to acknowledge each other first. Her approach is authentic, honest, and often hilarious. She speaks passionately about resilience, mental health and leadership, burnout, grief, and trauma. I'm so thrilled to bring to you this conversation I had with Dr. Jodi Carrington. Jodi, take it away.
Thank you so much for having me. I am so excited to dive into all of these great questions. I think that, you know, sometimes we have so many challenges in this season as parents and as caregivers and, you know, as, you know, trying to navigate these things. And Robbie, you've taken on, you know, the best of what it's like to be full of tears and full of hope and full of pride and all of those things and all of those moments. And I mean, this is what fuels me, I think, the most as a psychologist. So I started as a, you know, I was inspired by a teacher to do this work because I primarily felt seen by her for the first time that I can truly remember in grade 10. And I started this process, really, I don't really like kids. I still don't really like kids. But I, you know, I end up being a child psychologist. This is a spoiler alert. But what happens in that before I did that, you know, I worked as a motivational psychologist. I did 2 years as a civilian member with the RCMP, and I started to learn about organizational stress and trauma and, you know, what it means to look after the big people, you know, not just the people you serve. And then I did my residency in Nova Scotia, and I had to do a rotation with kids because they told me I had to. And I said, listen, I'm not a fan of the children. And they were like, you're kind of like one. We think you'd be a good fit. And they weren't wrong. And so I started to learn that we knew even less about kids and trauma, particularly with neurodevelopmental difficulties. And certainly I learned a lot more about, you know, kids in care and that experience and how, you know, really antiquated that system remains. You know, from a very behavioral perspective, that's how we operate still in this moment, in this very, very sacred space with kids who just need the most, utmost regulated care. We do not provide it to the best of our abilities, I think. And so then when I took my first job on a locked psychiatric inpatient unit at the Alberta Children's Hospital, that's where I sort of spent the first 10 years of my formal career. And I learned a lot about kids and attachment and trauma and emotional dysregulation that really formulated the way that I see the world today. I got married later in life, had three babies, you know, around 38. I had three kids under two at 38 years old. And I remember I don't really like kids. And so we moved back here where I'm now on Treaty 7 land in Olds, Alberta, Canada. We were raising our babies here. I just wanted a private practice and to coach hockey, and I started doing those things. And then I started to consult with schools around the kids that were really struggling, the kids who had neurodevelopmental difficulties, the ones who had behavioral concerns, you know, the hitters, the kidders, the biters, the ones to tell you to fuck off. I love those babies. And so I started to consult and then speak. And then I was in teacher conferences around North America and they said, can you write a book? And I said, sure. And so I self-published a little book called Kids These Days and it became a national bestseller. And then we wrote Teachers These Days for Educators in the Classroom on how to handle those tough kids. And then HarperCollins came to me and said, would you write a book that the world needs? And I said, let me think about it. Yeah. So I just wrote Feeling Seen, and pre-sales start on September 15th. It comes into the world in January 23. And it's all the same message with it. You know, when you're acknowledged, you rise. And the ones who need it the most are the hardest to give it to. And those are typically kids with a trauma history or who are not neurotypical kids. And how do we shore up the big people so that they can continue to stay regulated in for little babies, you know, big babies who don't have the history, the skill, the capacity, the neurological ability to stay regulated? How do we serve kids in that way? And so that's the focus of my platform, my career. That's my mission in life. And listen, I feel so lucky to be doing it from this very huge position of privilege.
Precisely. Yeah. You talked about the importance of regulation and connecting with our kids so that they can stay regulated. And absolutely, that's so true. When our kids feel seen and heard and safe, that's where we can build upon their strengths and build their resilience and build some skills in them so they can do better next time. So very important. But when they are the kids that you just so eloquently said are the hitters, the spitters, the biters, the swearers, and that happens in your home every day, and you get told all these, you know, you get called all these ugly words, and your own personal property is being destroyed by the very babies you love, it's hard to stay regulated yourself. Can you speak to the big people?
I get this question a lot about how do we stay regulated? And certainly as a child psychologist, you know, people will come to me all the time. Can you fix my kid? I'm worried about my kid. We have the best of intentions behind that. The kid is the issue, right? If they would just listen more or be less aggressive or, you know, not be so attention seeking or manipulative and they lie all the time. How do I sort of work on this? And so the thought was they're going to bring the kid to me so I can fix them. And here's the sad reality. I have assessed and treated over 1,000 kids in this country, and I have not one time met a bad kid. Not Agreed. One single time. I've met a lot of emotionally dysregulated kids who haven't had the people in their corners to teach them how to stay calm in times of distress. So the biggest bang for the buck, 99.9% of the, in fact, listen, I'll say this, 100% of the time, after the assessment is completed, because oftentimes you can't treat what you don't understand, I need to understand what's driving the behavior, the story of that kid. Is there a neurophysiological difficulty that we haven't addressed? Are they on the spectrum? Do they have FAS? What is the concern? What is their story? Then the biggest intervention always comes from a systems perspective. How can I best support teacher, mom, foster mom? What is the relation to biological parents? What is the relation to culture? What does that look like in order to assist in the emotional regulation? Because very rarely can one person provide that for a child, and never can a child do this alone. Okay. So the more you have on your plate to be able to stay regulated, to manage that, whether it's a mental health challenge, neurological difficulties, poverty, a lack of support, any of those things that sort of make it difficult to stay, marginalization in any way, it makes it difficult to stay regulated, which means the investment in the big people need to be upped exponentially. And not in a shaming way. You're not doing this. Your kid's an asshole. You are, you know, why aren't you providing for your kid? Why are you only sending a banana in their lunch? What is wrong with you? Do you even, that's the behavioral perspective that doesn't get us anywhere. What I love is to understand the sleepless nights, the tears, the anxiety, the desire for their babies to be better, do better, show up in this world as better human beings. And how do we work on that together? Understanding that they have to get dysregulated first, mm-hmm. in order to learn how to regulate. The chaos is necessary to learn the calm. And I think this is the part that we often mess up so many times is we just want the calm. So we try to remove triggers. We try to increase motivators. If you look at any IPP that generally, you know, still happens in most of our education system or many of our, you know, child and family services, behavioral support programs are really all around. How do we increase the motivators, decrease the triggers? But here's the problem. What if we had a plan for when kids lost their mind? Not like, what if we had all the triggers in place because we could, not that we were going to induce triggers to create distress, but when they are unavoidable, right? Transitions between foster homes, bedtime, teeth brushing, any of those things that cause emotional dysregulation, we're not going to just not put you to bed and not brush your teeth ever again. But what are we going to do when we have to keep you regulated during that time? How, what am I doing before, after? How do I sort of look at that piece of emotional regulation as something that is necessary to teach you how to do that more and more? The more we practice that staying calm in times of distress, the more access I have to that when my primary caregiver isn't there. So it's that shift in understanding around emotional dysregulation that is very much in the face of all behavioral models that we've really been raised in, right? Kids should be seen and not
heard. Exactly.
Now here's the problem. We used to, just two generations ago, had much more proximity to each other. So a strict behavioral model worked because we had relationship built in. We didn't know we needed to measure it. Our great grandparents looked at their children 72% more of the time than we make eye contact with our children, due to a number of things, technological advances, and mostly physical proximity. Think about the square footage of the house that your grandfather was raised in and the square footage of the house in which we raise our babies.
Fair.
My father grew up in a one-bedroom house. He was the oldest of three boys, didn't have running water until he was 17 years old, right? And very privileged. I mean, we're white, straight, able-bodied, lived in a farming community, but this wasn't a hardship. This is what they had. And my grandmother, you know, was there every day. They baked, they cooked, they did things as a family. They saw each other way more than we see our kids. And I still am in this place, white, straight, able-bodied, privileged, you know, with money. I do this. I look at my kids far less because I'm on my computer, they're on their iPads. Our world has shifted. So it's not about shifting back to what works before, because we live in a world where best practices that were established two generations ago no longer exists. How do we function in this world today means we need to be on purpose, staying connected to our children and really understanding how we work through that emotional dysregulation states.
I was just speaking yesterday with my mom group, all adoptive parents, all adoptive moms whose kids have very difficult presentations, many different diagnoses, including FASD, autism, Tourette syndrome, ADHD, like all ADHD, all kinds of things are going on in all of our homes. And we were laughing and joking about some of the stuff that goes on in our homes. In hindsight, we can do that. And that's part of resilience, is being able to not take it personally and be able to move forward and even process it with each other. In the moment, though, in the moment when that child is refusing to go to bed, or more likely refusing to brush their teeth, we need to remember that when the words are flying and the resistance is happening, it's not personal. As parents, we need to remember Q-tip, Q-T-I-P, quit taking it personally. It's not about you. It's not about the kid even. That kid is just dysregulated at that moment. For whatever reason, that transition of brushing their teeth is so difficult. And I haven't understood all the complexities of that yet, but it could be their own fatigue, sensory processing issues, maybe too many instructions at one time. This is hard, and it was hard yesterday, and I had a big reaction. So today I just feel like I'm having a big reaction again because I had one yesterday to this very thing. So parents, if we could just take a breath, just go, hey, this isn't about you, isn't about the kid. It's like, my kid's having a hard time. What is it my kid needs from me right now?
Here's how I want you to judge your kid. Okay. Think about them in their finest moment when you have been proudest of them. Okay. So I know you told me five children. So if I think about my three babies, if I think about the moments where I was the most proud of them individually, all three of them are very, very different. All five of yours are very, very different. If I just pick one, for example, and get them in my head right now and think about when I've been the proudest of my daughter or my sons, I think of them in situations where they're using their words, or they're communicating, they're kind, they're empathic, they're doing all of these things, or using their manners. Okay. That is who your kid is.
Yes.
That if you think about yourself in your finest moments, I want you to think about the time where you were proudest of your parenting ability, when your kid was having a meltdown, or when, you know, they looked at you and just said, Mom, I'm so grateful for you, or, you know, they loved you, or they gave you that look with their eyes that, you know, they're so connected to you. When you have been proudest of yourself, okay, that is who you are as a parent. All right. Now, when you think about you or your child in a dysregulated state, so a dysregulated state is a three-year-old with a temper tantrum, an adult in a bar fight. When you are screaming and yelling and saying things like, I don't care if you leave, you want another mom, go find one. When we've said things like that to our children. Okay. Now, that's emotional dysregulation. So when you look at a kid, so for example, a three-year-old, if you ever stood by a three-year-old who is regulated, using their manner, sharing with their sibling, maybe your mother-in-law is standing there going, oh, wow, she's amazing. And you're like, you damn, she is. You're welcome. And you're proud. And then 22 seconds later, you say, no, baby girl, you can't have a ring pop for breakfast. And she says, I hate you, and flips the chair, takes her clothes off, pees, says, get fucked or something. And your mother-in-law goes, ah! Now, what has happened to that baby? Have they just lost their ability to speak and use their manners? Have they just had a stroke? No, they've lost access to it because they're emotionally dysregulated. And when you see somebody in a bar fight, you know, you start the beginning evening, you're dancing with them, you're looking, I could get married, everything's lovely, and they get in a bar fight and they're punching somebody and saying, I'm going to effing kill you. Have they lost their ability to two-step? Have they lost their ability to have dinner with your parents next week? No, they've lost access to it. That's the definition of emotional dysregulation, and is one of the most important lessons we can teach our children. And when you are hypersensitive, when you are cognitively, there's something neurologically that allows you to be more prickly to this world, which is so true for kids on the spectrum, mm-hmm. which is so true for kids with ADHD, which is so true for kids with any, you know, neural-based disability, then what we need to do is figure out how we provide a system that allows them to stay more regulated, that supports them in learning how to do that in their own bodies to the best of their ability, and understand that the system around them then will have to walk them home. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a Ram Dass quote that I have to talk about. He's a dead guy who was a yogi and a philosopher. And this is my favorite phrase in the human language. You can see it hanging over my shoulder. He said this: we are all just here walking each other home. And if you have been blessed with a non-neurotypical child, if you are an adoptive parent, if you're a foster parent listening to this, first of all, from the bottom of this mama's soul, you are doing holy work. You are a hero, because our biggest job as parents is to take our baby's most dysregulated moments, or the most dysregulated moments of somebody else's biological child, and walk them home. Mm-hmm. Again and again. This is why teachers are holy. This is why first responders are holy in my world, because we serve people who are in their most dysregulated states. That's my job as a psychologist, right? As an emergency room physician, as a police officer, you are saying, as a foster parent, you're saying, I don't want a compliant kid. I want a kid who has not had somebody who can withstand their ugliest, messiest, bullshittiest moments. And I want to be the one that says, put me in. I got you, baby girl. Not okay when you yell at me. Nope. I'm keeping you safe. Not okay. We do not hit here, but look at me. Look at me. I got you. Mm-hmm. Let's have a snack and figure this out again and again and again. And here's the problem with this work, is it's never an end game, and very few people acknowledge you. So we need our people, podcasts like this, our own therapist, to be able to say, you are absolutely doing what you need to be doing again and again and again and again and again.
Thank you, Jody, from the bottom of my heart. And the thousands of people listening to this podcast, thank you so much for that validation and helping us to feel seen and to recognize holy work. And holy work is hard work.
Oh,
every day as she hangs her head. And it's never ending, just like laundry. It's never ending.
Oh my God. And it's like, and you don't even get anything out of it. Like, even when you get your laundry done, you're a little bit like, whew, okay, yeah, got that done. Sometimes when you get your kid to bed and they just told you to fuck off and, you know, wrecked your you know, the door's now off its hinges, you're like, oh, lovely. Yes. You're sleeping. Yes. Right. And I just questioned humanity and myself. And there's nobody there to just be like, good job, mama.
Good job, mama.
We did that. Woo! That was successful. Because then they wake up the next morning and they're like, I still hate you. You know, and you're like, shit, I thought we
had that covered.
No, we didn't. Okay, cool. But I think that's the whole point. And, you know, in my work with, I mean, some of the biggest work in my world that I feel the luckiest enough to have had the opportunity to do is when, you know, foster parents invite me into their home, or when, you know, we talk about adoptive parents, and particularly when there's been massive attachment or massive trauma histories, you don't fix those things.
Thank you for saying that.
You don't. And that's not your job, right? Our job is to not fix it. Our job is to understand it and to know that, you know, being able to show a kid who has been neurophysiologically damaged because of, you know, likely somebody's ability, you know, listen, I've never met a mom or a dad, a biological mom or a dad, who didn't want to do the best by their child.
100%.
And the ones who I've ever been involved in apprehensions with or done supervised visits for, they love those babies just as much or even more than I love my own children. I will promise you that in 99.9% of the cases, nobody was able to do it for them.
Yeah.
And you can't give away something you've never received. And if you are in a position to give it away as a foster parent, as an adoptive parent, as a psychologist, as a therapist, as a police officer, oh my Jesus, thank you so much. And remember, that is your job, to walk them home, not to fix them, not to discipline them, not to take enough shit away so that they suddenly decide to be kind. It is to walk them home again and again, and with limits, with boundaries, with effectiveness, with being able to show them that there is consequences to their actions. But our job is to be kind and not tolerate bullshit, in that order.
I love that. And I have found with my own kids, I mean, it's a learning journey, right? Got, like I said, 5 children, 4 of whom adopted, all 4 prenatally exposed to alcohol, trauma, poly substances. Yeah, shit's real in my house. And so I've learned and grown a lot as a parent. And one thing in the last, let's say 2 years, it's been utterly transformative, is when I changed my game in my head from, you're going to get on my team or else, is I'm on your team no matter what. And I say that to my kids, I am on your team no matter what. Tell me the truth. You're not going to be in trouble. And you know what? I mean, tell me the truth when you stole money. Tell me the truth when you broke into this place or that place, or, you know, whatever. Tell me the truth. I'm on your team and we'll figure it out. They're not in trouble. Okay. That doesn't mean there aren't consequences, but it means mom doesn't lose her shit and mom's not going to take away everything you own. It's, we'll figure it out, but I'm on your team.
Robbie, and I love that.
It's walking them home. I want them to be safe. I want them to be in relationship. If they don't have relationship with a mama bear who's got their back no matter what, it's just going to devolve. It's going to go bad, and it's going to stay bad at home, and I'm going to lose them. And then who's going to advocate for them?
And it doesn't mean you give them everything they want. It doesn't mean that you acquiesce to everything. It doesn't mean they could treat you like shit. None of those things.
No, that doesn't
mean
that.
We often get misunderstood in this place, right? Like, I would often come into a unit where, you know, a kid was just destroyed, it told everybody to fuck off. And the nurse would say to me, if you give this kid a cookie, I'm fucking leaving. And I would be like, okay, first of all, I think you need a cookie, but I didn't say that out loud. And so there was lots of times where we would have to sort of explain the why behind regulating first and then teaching. The why behind regulating first and then teaching. Because if I come out of the gate consequencing, which is how we've been taught to parent many times, I don't have a kid who can learn it, because they're dysregulated. And an emotionally dysregulated kid can't learn. You can have the best consequence or the best plan on the planet, but if they're dysregulated, they cannot learn. Not because they don't want to, but because they can't. Okay. So if somebody's in a bar fight and I came up to them right to their face and yelled at them, use your words, calm down, they're going to throw punch you, right? Yeah. Because all they have left from a neurophysiological perspective is fight, flight, and freeze. Not because they're assholes, not because they're attention manipulative seeking liars, something. It's because all they have access to right now is fight, flight, or freeze. So I need to get you back down. Here's some ways that get you back down. Look at me, even kids on the spectrum. I try to get eyes just even briefly, right? Let's have a snack. If they won't eat, I will say, let's have a drink. Just take it one drink and then we'll talk. No, I hate water. Do you have juice? Okay.
I do.
Do not die on the juice hill. You go get fucking juice. If it is 20 minutes, or I would say, you know, baby girl, I don't have juice, but can I get you some water with ice?
Mm-hmm.
Fine. Yeah. And the second I can get you to swallow, you see, you can't swallow with the flipped prefrontal cortex. It is biologically impossible. So I use food oftentimes not as a reward, but as a way to get babies safer, children safer around me. So I know they will not hurt themselves or me. And when I get you in that state, even if you take it, they might throw it at me, right? We're going to go, we could go around again and again and again and again. That's fine. But in those moments, if I can just pull you back a little bit and you just take a drink, the other cue is a deep breath. I just want to go out tonight and you're not listening to me. I don't care what's coming out of your mouth. If I watch your body go down, you can't take a deep breath with a flip lid. Biologically impossible. If a kid is very upset, if you're very upset, their breathing is shallow. Because I need a prefrontal cortex to take a deep breath, which is why we often give the cue, take a deep breath. Huh? But it is much easier to show a kid how to do it than it is to tell them, look at me. Okay. We're going to solve this. Let's take a drink. Okay. But I want to go. I know you do. We're going to talk about that. I promise you. Deep breath. And then I have a much more reasonable human. I might flip again. I mean, I spent hours on the locked unit going in and out of that state of emotional regulation. Fuck you. Get out of this room. Slam the door. Okay. And then I stay and we come back in and we try it again. And we come back in and we try it again. Right. Until I'm exhausted. Somebody else has to take over. We say that's enough. Nope. Tonight it's bedtime. You know, whatever that is, right?
Yep.
Whenever possible, this is a Hoffman Cooper word. They've taken John Bowlby's work and put it into the Circle of Security. This is The Securely Attached Child, one of my favorite books. They say, whenever possible, follow a child's need. Whenever necessary, take charge. So I'm going to sit in with you as long as I possibly can. And then when all bets are off, I'm done, or it's not safe for you, enough.
Yeah.
Okay. So it is that beautiful piece of John Bowlby's original attachment work that is, we need to be both things, but mostly we need to be in charge. In charge. Secure base, safe haven, again and again and again in regulating those emotions. And this is why parenting, foster parenting, adoptive parenting, parenting, like navigating children, period, coaching, teaching, any of those things is exhausting.
Which goes back Dr. Jody doesn't like kids. Let's go back.
I don't like kids. I don't know how you people do that. I'm exhausted. I mean, I think that, you know, this is why our biggest, you know, I think bang for, I don't know, I even like to say that, but our biggest investment as a culture, as a society needs to be in big people, educators, foster parents, adoptive parents, parents, period. If I start to look after those people, you're only as okay as the people who hold you.
Yep.
And if the people who hold you think that you're a psychopathic serial killer, you will not do well in this world. So I need really to explore that worry, that fear, that story about the child that you're walking home, and really take a look at whether there's truth to that. Now, there may be seasons when those kids are emotionally dysregulated that we do have to have safety plans in place and organize all those things. But if I come at every kid as a violent, disregarding psychopath, right? I've never met a kid like that. I've met a kid with I've met many kids with labels like that.
Yeah.
But I have, once you see a child, they're beautiful humans. And it doesn't mean you don't put resources in place to keep you and everybody else safe. That's not what I'm talking about. But it is not, it's not if we're going to regulate them, it's how. It's
acknowledging, I think, how precious they are as an individual. And that kid, that little 5-year-old or 6-year-old that's calling you every name in the book and is trashing and maybe is biting kids at school, like that little person might be really hard to love. But if we can recognize that's not the essence of who they are, if we go back to who they are when they're regulated, who they are when they feel attached, then that's the essence of that child. And that child, when they flip their lid, they don't have the capacity. So that's exactly what you're saying. I love it. How do I support the big people? How do I teach the big people to see this child as this precious, vulnerable human being that needs a lot of attachment, a lot of security, and a lot of supervision to keep themselves and other people around them safe? But
yes.
When we can keep them safe and happy, that's when we can teach and that's when we can regulate. And I love it.
And can we just say this? This is maybe the most critical thing I'm going to say today. The biggest thing we have to do is give ourselves grace.
Oh, yeah.
You only need to get this shit right 30% of the time. You can fuck it up 70% of the time because you're exhausted. You have lots of things on your plate. You have nobody sees how hard you work, how much you cry yourself to sleep, how much you love these kids. You beat yourself up so many times when you lose your shit and lose your mind. Our biggest point right now is grace for us big people. You are doing a beautiful job. And a little bit of this is so much better than none of this. And I really want you to think about that 30% of the time. This is, there's some beautiful research around this. And that's not a get out of jail card. That is a, when you worry that you're messing it up all the time, you are very unable to stay present with your child. You are doing the best you can on any given day. And I promise you it's enough. That's the biggest message I want you to take away from today is that we need to give ourselves grace when we step into the place of really dysregulated people, when we do the work of emergency room physicians or police officers or teachers or mental health providers, foster parents, adoptive parents, all of these things, huh? We need to give each other some grace and look for community so that we can stay filled up to do this very critically life-changing work.
Let's end it right there. I mean, what more could we say? Thank you so much, Dr. Carrington, for being with me today and speaking love and joy and hope and real into the many, many parents, caregivers, grandparents, and professionals who listen to this podcast.
Thanks for having me, Robbie. It was such an honor.
If you'd like to know more about Dr. Jody and the work she's doing, I've put links in the show notes for you. Do you feel alone in your journey raising your kids or your grandkids with fetal alcohol spectrum disorder? You don't have to. I've created the FASD Family Life Community for you. It's an online support group, and we meet monthly to share our wins, our struggles, and to learn from one another about fetal alcohol spectrum disorder and effective ways of supporting our kids and ourselves using a brain-based approach. Our support group is a fun, lively place to connect with other parents who get it. And together, we will deepen our understanding of FASD, the neurobehavioral model, and build a community of support. You can sign up in the show notes. It's a monthly subscription of $20 a month. And as always, thank you for your time. I know it's precious. And until next week, remember, the struggle is real and so is success. I'll speak with you soon.